The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in January, Britain's parliament was compelled to debate whether to ban Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump from visiting the UK. Why? Because by law, any petition with more than 100,000 signatures must be considered by Parliament's Petition Committee. And more than 500,000 people had signed one, accusing Trump of using language against Muslims that violated Britain's hate speech statutes. It was a rare glimpse of British democracy in action for many Americans, most of whom know more about the love lives of the royals than parliamentary politics. Many Brits, however, keep a close eye on America's presidential primary. That's thanks to correspondents like Dan Roberts, Washington bureau chief for The Guardian. He's been following the Bernie Sanders campaign as well as the election at large, and we reached him in a very loud and busy room. Dan Roberts, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me on. I'm enjoying the New Hampshire weather.
Well, we finally got some snow.
Yes.
The Iowa caucuses, that's hard for people to comprehend, even, you know, those of us who have to relearn it every 4 years here in the U.S. How is it to explain the caucuses to people outside of the country?
Well, I think people are fascinated, really, and people have always been interested in U.S. politics. We write a lot for U.S. audience as well. But the foreign audience, I think, is particularly interested this year round because the candidates seem to many eyes so extreme. You know, you've got Donald Trump at one end and Bernie Sanders on the other end. And people are very puzzled how this will shake down. And we have remarkable levels of interest in the intricacies of the Iowa caucus system.
So your readers have an appetite for picking apart the minutiae.
Yes, I think people always enjoy the horse race element of politics. And I think this year the stakes seem particularly high. So people are very intent on deciphering just who is ahead and studying all the polls as much as they are in the U.S.
So the field is starting to thin out a bit since Iowa, especially. But there have been a lot of candidates on the GOP side, 17 initially. Do your readers know all the contenders or just the loudest ones?
Well, I think for a while it was all Jeb and all Donald. I mean, there was a sense in which name recognition, much as it did, I think, for the domestic U.S. audience was the primary factor. I think we're slowly finding that people are getting interested in what Ted Cruz stands for, how much of a threat to the Democrats Marco Rubio might pose. And people are very much getting interested in Bernie Sanders. There's a huge international appetite for finding out about him.
So are those the candidates that have really gained some momentum or popularity there in the UK?
Yeah, I think so. I think people see Bernie in particular through the lens of a similar left-wing candidate who's done very well in British politics called Jeremy Corbyn. So there is interest there. And I think people are also interested in the sort of anti-immigration backlash that we've seen among many Republicans, which also mirrors much of the politics that's going on in Europe right now.
Well, Dan, I know you've held a couple of different positions there at The Guardian and written for other newspapers. Do you feel like you have to write or report stories differently for The Guardian audience than you might if you were a reporter for The New York Times, for example?
I don't know. I mean, most of our readers are here. We have more readers actually in the U.S. now than we do in the U.K. online, and we're not far behind the Times in readership. But we can't dumb it down because people read everything anywhere on the internet. You can't sort of force people to read one story or another. But it's certainly the case that the British newspaper readership is only slowly catching up with the twists and turns in this debate. They've only really switched on in the last week or so. So when I'm writing for the newspaper, which is a small part of what we do, then you do have to take your time and explain the background.
And how about the description of, you know, New Hampshire, Iowa? What is it like to kind of portray those places to an audience abroad?
A lot of fun, actually. I was really moved by the Iowa caucuses. I'd never been before, and I found the actual process of sitting in a room as people conducted democracy out in the open a very emotionally moving experience. It has its oddities, certainly, but it's much more visceral than watching people kind of stick envelopes in ballot boxes, and I thought that in particular was wonderful. New Hampshire, I think, has its own quirks. I love this tradition of people making up their minds at the last minute here, which is certainly borne out by every voter I've spoken to, and I think that speaks very well on the state, I think. It's a healthy attribute.
Well, you know, I'm sure you know some of the old tomes about being a reporter covering a campaign. The Boys on the Bus is something that comes to mind. You're covering the Sanders campaign, which is a very different kind of campaign. It's, you know, at least in presentations, getting by on a wing and a prayer with not a lot of big money behind it. What's that experience like?
Well, it's been an amazing journey, really, because I've been following them since May. And at the beginning, it was very much as you've just described. It was very much on a shoestring. And access was a lot easier. And they were very friendly. And they're still pretty friendly. But one of the things that's changed this week, for example, is they now have Secret Service protection, which has changed everything at the events. There's now people wanding you as you come in and the motorcade. And that's definitely slowed things down. And the other thing you can say now is that they're not short of money. You know, I mean, it's not like they're sort of dripping with gold and everything's very lavish, but it certainly feels like a more professional operation. Now they're bringing in $20 million in January, which is more than Clinton.
American pundits have looked at this election as a bit of an anomaly. You know, all of the outside candidates are doing much better than establishment candidates. And few people could have predicted Trump's lasting popularity or the rise of Bernie as an alternative to Hillary, let's say, a year ago. How about pundits and opinion columnists overseas? Are they equally befuddled by the 2016 race so far?
I think they are, but in a funny kind of way, a little bit of distance can help give you perspective. And I think on both fronts, if you look at the rise of nationalism and populist anger over immigration in Europe, it's much easier to understand what's going on with Donald Trump. And I think likewise, that a lot of what Bernie Sanders is saying, whilst appearing extreme to many US eyes, actually by international standards is quite moderate. I mean, his universal health care, family leave, free public college, these are all things that are quite normal to lots of people in the rest of the developed world. So again, there he is easier to understand perhaps than to people who haven't seen him over here.
Where are you going to be on Tuesday night, Dan?
I'm hoping to be at the Bernie party. I was there on caucus night in Iowa, and it was that felt like a celebration even though they didn't actually win. So I don't know what it's going to be like if they do win this time. It could be very loud.
How closely do you think the rest of the world is going to be watching on Tuesday night?
I think very closely. I mean, I think this is, particularly in the Republican race, this is a defining moment where the field could literally be cut by two-thirds the day after the primary on Tuesday. And on the Democratic side, I think also we'll find out whether Bernie's for real. You know, if he wins by 20 points, then I think it's game on. This is going to go all the way. If he fizzles out and Clinton can close that lead to single digits, then you've got to ask yourself, well, is he really going to go that far? So I think on both sides, people are watching these races enormously closely in New Hampshire. As ever, this is a state that tells the rest of the country where to go.
Dan Roberts, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dan Roberts, he's Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Guardian, and he has been following the Bernie Sanders campaign. He's with them on the road right now.
America does democracy better than any other nation on earth. Just look back to where it starts. Every election cycle, Iowa. Once every 4 years. All of a sudden, we decide to, out of nowhere, give a shit about Iowa. And I think I know why. It's the Iowa caucuses. They're so folksy. There is nothing more folksy than the Iowa caucus. Neighbours gathering in each other's homes, discussing who they want to vote for, writing down their choices on pieces of paper, having those pieces of paper counted up by other local volunteers. It's pure Americana. It couldn't be any more folksy or wholesome unless Huckleberry Finn suddenly walked in, carrying a freshly baked apple pie and started dropping the N-word.
And that is the British-born John Oliver, host of HBO's This Week Tonight, with his take on American direct democracy. When it finally comes time for voters to cast their ballots, they're often checked in by volunteers, some of whom have been working at the same polling station for years. In San Diego, big rig driver Boyd Applegate hauls freight for a living, but each election day he comes home to volunteer at the polls. He has worked nearly every election, primary and general, for the past 20 years. He spoke with his sister Rhonda Dixon for StoryCorps.
My day starts at about 4 o'clock when I put all the ballots and materials in the car and I drive about 25 miles to where this precinct is at. And every morning when we open the polls, there is a particular voter. He's right there. He's always my first voter. After that, the rest of the day, I'm being greeted before I can even look up from the table and see who's there. They go, oh, you're here again. Hi. People tell me about their families, and I have a lot of friendships solely based on election day.
So do you take time off of your regular job so that you can do the elections?
Oh, absolutely. My regular job is I'm a truck driver. And December of this year, I will achieve the 5 million mile mark.
So, Boyd, why do you still do the work that you do volunteering at the polls on election day?
Over the years, I've run into many people who are naturalized citizens. They've come from all over the world. I've had people approach me and ask me, how much do I have to pay to cast my ballot? I've had people with tears in their eyes, grown people who are voting for the first time in their life because the country where they come from, they didn't have that right. And if I can help lighten the mood and set them at ease that they're doing fine and there is no wrong way to vote, I honestly believe that what I am doing is important. I'm there as a representative of what's right in America, and I enjoy it.
What would you like people to remember you for?
I'd like anybody who ever knew me to remember me for having a heart. I found my heart somewhere along the way, and I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I can share it with people.
Boyd Applegate there, who also won the Goodyear Highway Hero Award in 1993 for saving three people from auto accidents. That story was recorded in San Diego for StoryCorps. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR and Virginia Prescott. Between the paltry snow cover and spring-like temperatures, suffice it to say this has been a very strange New Hampshire winter, and the unseasonably warm temperature has put a dent in many winter activities, among the hardest hit, ice fishing. So what is someone to do if they just want a hook, line, and sinker this winter? Well, here with some answers are Dave Kellum and Clay Groves. They are hosts of the Fish Nerds podcast. Hello, Dave and Clay.
Hello.
Hello.
Great to have you back with us. So has there been much ice fishing this winter?
Yeah, there has. The trick is being safe and being smart about getting out on the ice because ice forms in different ways in different places.
Has there been ice in officially declared in New Hampshire or anywhere this year?
So ice in Winnipesaukee, I don't think has been declared. Winnipesaukee's been a very tough lake this year to fish, but there's tons of small ponds that have been we call relatively safe. You know, safe is a term we don't use on the ice. It's all relative to where you're fishing right now. So each angler is responsible for their own safety. But there are people fishing Winnipesaukee today. I drove by this morning
what?
And saw people on the ice. So,
I have to drive past Turkey Pond when when I come and go to work. And I noticed that it was looking absolutely sloshy there yesterday. So how do people determine? I mean, obviously you can see, but is there any official declaration?
There are some tips and tricks that anglers do. And early ice anglers will often have spikes that are these 6-inch long things with handles that they put around their neck. So when they fall in, they have something to grip and pull themselves out with.
Right, but those aren't very good for determining ice thickness.
No.
What you really want to do is what I generally do is let someone else go out first with a bigger truck or snowmobile than me. But what you really want to do is you want to check as you go. So the recommendation is you get a big spud or a big pole with a heavy chisel on the end of it. And you take a few steps out, and you try to chisel to the ice. If it goes through really easy, get off the ice. Mm. But really, over 4 inches, 4 to 6 inches is pretty comfortable to be on. And beyond that, it just gets better and better.
So as far as ice fishing is concerned, is this an unusual winter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Usually, I can start ice fishing in the end of November, beginning of December, and can fish till April. This year, I didn't get on until almost January, which is way crazy. And there are spots that we fished for years that we can't touch this year because of the warm weather.
What happens to the fishes and aquatic life cycle when there is no ice cover? I mean, is it kind of business as usual, or is ice part of it all?
Well, they've been dealing with fluctuating situations for eons, as long as they've been around. But typically, ice will seal in all the oxygen in a pond or in a lake. So when there is ice, for the most part, there's not going to be any more oxygen. So there, the clock is ticking for the spring to open up the water and get oxygen back in the system. Now, if sunlight can get through the ice, the weeds will still produce oxygen. But as soon as you get snow, it really diminishes. So from a fish's point of view, it's probably not the worst thing in the world to have some open water on a lake because it aerates it and they don't suffocate. On really bad winters like last year, although I'm not sure I heard about this in specifically New Hampshire, but certainly out in the Midwest, whole lakes will have a die-off, a winter kill is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And the fish just suffocate. So when the ice melts, there's just piles of fish laying around that have suffocated.
That's part of the natural cycle?
Yeah, yes. It is. Because they will respond, they will rebound. And not every fish dies. So, you know, 90% may die, but those 10% will repopulate. But yeah, it is part of the natural cycle.
Which fish are people actually catching when they're ice fishing?
There are several different kinds. There's two big families, I guess you would say, in New Hampshire. Cold water species, warm water species. Cold water are typically more like the native brook trout would be one. So a lot of trout anglers like to fish. They like to fish in shallow water up near sandy areas.
And isn't it moving? Doesn't it have to be moving for trout?
No. And in lakes, not at all, or ponds. Pretty much you stock a trout somewhere, it'll be happy to live there.
Well, the fun thing about trout fishing is the reason they're fishing shallow is trout will chase small fish into the shallow water and use the ice to trap the fish. It kind of crowds them in, and then they gobble them up. And so trout anglers typically will fish in 1 to 2 feet of water, which, if you're looking for a relatively safe way to fish, maybe you want to fish really shallow. If you fall through, you just walk out.
Yeah, you just walk out, exactly.
Clever trout, yeah. Clever fisherman there, yeah. In that case. Okay, so that's a question. Is there a gender-neutral term for fisherman?
Angler.
Yeah.
Good job, guys.
Yeah. Although I know women who can refer to themselves as fishermen.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, Linda Greenlaw calls herself a lobsterman.
Yeah,
see?
Right? Exactly.
This is just how it goes. All right. I've always wondered about what happens to bob houses after these quick shifts. Because, you know, you'll see them there over the weekend and then the ice is gone. What happened? Are there a bunch of bob houses remains sinking in the bottom of ponds?
There are. And I'm sure there's some we'll never know about until some diver finds them. But what happens with a bob house, especially if this year has been a really good example. A shanty gets put out, and it's doing fine, and then the water warms up, we get some snow and slush, and what happens is really slowly the ice swallows the shanty, because heat generates out from the shanty, not from the heaters in it, but the sun bouncing off of it and that sort of thing. And so they can get swallowed by the lake. And this year, with the crazy fluctuation in temperatures, it's going to happen a lot. Alton Bay the other day, several shanties met their match there, and I'm sure there's a lot of pieces of shanty at the bottom, because you have to go out with a chainsaw and a bunch of tools and ropes and just drag pieces of those things off the ice once they go down.
Is anybody responsible for that? I mean, are you supposed to take care of your own bob house?
Yeah, typically anglers take care of their own stuff. A lot of people who own hardside shanties, that's what they call them, hardsides, will have to go out every day, and they do what's called blocking them up, which is they jack them up and they put blocks of wood under to keep the skis off of the ice. So as the ice starts swallowing the shanty, it doesn't swallow the skis, it just swallows the blocks of wood. So it's kept a few inches above the ice all the time. It's a lot of work having a hard side shanty.
Yeah,
that's why I don't have one. I am lazy and don't want to do it.
Some hard living.
Yeah. The other thing in New Hampshire is it's a law that you have to put your name and address on your shanty. So in real big letters, it's got to be out there. So if it's sinking, somebody can walk by and call you and go, hey, dude. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's the only building regulation. That's it. Put your name on it, kid.
So you can say, hey, dude, come watch it sing.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Well, OK, so, you know, ice fishing is a very social activity. Mm-hmm. However, you know, it's a time for solitude. Are people feeling at a loss when we have a winter like this?
One of the saddest places on the internet is iceshanty.com.
Oh!
You go on there and there's threads like, oh, I fell in today. Oh. My shanty's gone. I'm dying.
Yeah, I bought a new snowmobile this year and can't use it. That's my thread. You know, it's crazy.
I have to actually talk to my family.
Yeah. Yeah, stuff like that.
I know you guys are family guys. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
One more question for you.
Yes.
So last year we came on.
Oh, no.
And we asked you if you've ever been ice fishing, and you said no. And have you been out since?
Yeah, I've been out.
Yeah, I've been out fishing.
So what Clay's getting at is that there
you
is...
You know what? This was going to be the year for me.
But your spot is gone?
Well, we can find ice. Yeah. We can definitely get you out there. And here's another open invitation that we will take you ice fishing.
Okay. Thank you so much, guys. You're welcome. I've been really waiting for that. The Fish Nerds, Dave Kellum and Clay Groves, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Dave Kellum and Clay Groves are hosts of the Fish Nerds podcast. You'll find a link to listen to it for yourself on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The moon landing? Faked. 9/11? An inside job. Deflategate? Brady was framed. There are countless conspiracy theories out there, all presenting evidence that history as we know it was intentionally altered. Sometimes for huge, diabolical purposes, sometimes in small, practically insignificant ways. One reason conspiracy theories tend to stick around is that some of them, not many, but some, turn out to be true. Todd Van Luling is senior staff writer at the Huffington Post, and he recently investigated what may be one of the most obscure online conspiracy theories and discovered that there just may be some truth to the claim after all. Todd, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so if you can, in one sentence, explain the theory that you looked into for your story.
All right. So basically, the story looked into the conspiracy theory that in 1993, Michael Jackson secretly tried to compose the soundtrack to Sonic 3, and at this time, Michael Jackson would have been at the height of his popularity, and so would have Sonic. So it would have been a really kind of big marriage of cultural forces.
And for those who didn't play it, what is Sonic 3?
That was the third installment in a popular video game series that focused around the character Sonic the Hedgehog. And in the 90s, Sonic the Hedgehog was just as popular as Mario and the kind of Nintendo counterparts. But Sonic was on the Sega consoles.
Okay, so you profiled Ben Mallison, who may be the first person to propose this connection between Sonic the Hedgehog 3, or Sonic 3, and Michael Jackson. Now, what is his story, Ben's?
So he was the hero in our piece. He was a huge Sonic fan, and growing up in the Sonic forums and spending a lot of his time doing that. But he was also named after Michael Jackson's song, Ben. And so he claimed to us that he's always kind of had a knack for noticing similarities between different songs. And he was the first, or at least it appears that he was the first, to notice that there was kind of a similar sample use in song structure between a track in Sonic 3 and with Michael Jackson's album Dangerous.
Ben was what they call a blue, a hardcore Sonic fan, again named after the Michael Jackson song Ben. One of Ben's original claims was that Jam, this is Michael Jackson's lead track from the album Dangerous, was similar to Carnival Night Zone from the Sonic 3 soundtrack. So let's hear the two together. Seriously? I mean, do you hear much similarity between those two?
Well, it's not that the two songs are necessarily the same. What he was noticing was the glass shattering being the same. And then there's a couple just note lines that are similar between the two. And so he was at least proposing that it seems weird that there's these similarities because they're kind of, they'd be obscure things to put into two songs unless you were the same person behind the two.
So he put this out there in like 2003. What did the Sonic community think? Were they convinced, dubious?
I think a little bit of both, certainly. But once the claims were out there, it kind of just snowballed, and that's when the conspiracy theories really started. And so even though they weren't really going on much evidence, there certainly were a lot of people in the Sonic community trying to reach out to everyone credited on Sonic 3 to try to figure out what was going on.
So how did the Sonic 3 developers take that?
Most of them, they weren't too happy about it. As you could imagine, if a bunch of 90s kid internet conspiracy lovers are constantly finding your phone number and sending you postage and sending emails and all that, a few of them were certainly overwhelmed, and they tried to just block that off.
Okay, so but these Blues, the Sonic fans, catch a big break in this theory in around 2004-5. What happened then?
So the head of the Sonic 3 project, someone named Roger Hechter, he was the lead at a development facility that Sega ran called STI, or the Sega Technical Institute. And so this was the person in charge of Sonic 3. And a Sonic forum user had an interview with Roger Hechter just asking about various Sonic stuff. And he threw in a question about whether Michael Jackson was involved. And at the time, Roger Hechter said that he actually was, and that Michael Jackson was brought on to do the soundtrack for Sonic 3. But then when the child molestation allegations came out, Sega just scrapped all the tracks, and that they were redone in-house.
So Michael Jackson worked with Sega? I mean, how did this happen? Any idea?
Well, apparently Michael Jackson was a big fan of Sonic at the time, and so he actually requested a special visit of the STI offices where they were making Sonic to kind of meet with the people behind the game. And at least according to Hechter, this is when it was kind of jokingly proposed that he should do the soundtrack to Sonic 3.
Well, here's a little bit more of a Sonic example, if I can use that term. Here are the ending credits, which have been remixed with Stranger in Moscow. Did Michael Jackson secretly compose the music for the 1994 video game Sonic the Hedgehog 3? We're speaking with Todd Van Luling, senior staff writer at the Huffington Post, who looked into this strange conspiracy theory. You found out about this guy Hechter, but what were you particularly able to add to the base of evidence for this conspiracy theory?
So the big thing we tried to do with this story is reach out to the composers who are credited on the game and try to see their take on it. And these are the same people that the Sonic community had been reaching out to for over two decades, trying to get their story. And we got a few of them to open up to us. And the thing about these composers is a lot of them had worked with Michael Jackson on different projects. And so even though Michael Jackson's name isn't on the credits, his team is credited in Sonic 3. And so the main one, Brad Buxer, who was Michael Jackson's musical director at the time, he was talking about how they wrote the Stranger in Moscow track, and that ended up in the end credits of the game. And he was also claiming that the music that they turned in absolutely made it into the game. But Michael Jackson didn't want his name associated with it because of the kind of bleepy bloopy nature of the Sega console at the time.
What do you think his real involvement might have been in putting this music together?
So in talking to the composers involved, and actually the producer who ran the studio during these sessions, people explained that Michael Jackson has a way of songwriting where he actually beatboxes. And so he kind of has the initial song idea, and then it's the composing team's job to kind of put it into notes. And for this for these sessions, they actually wrote the tracks like any other song they would normally write, and then it was the Sega job to kind of convert that into the different noises.
So what do you think, Todd? I mean, have you proved the theory correct, or will this only be conclusive if Sega admitted that Jackson collaborated on the soundtrack officially, which thus far the company has not done?
I think at this point it's pretty clear that Michael Jackson did do at least some of the tracks that are on the Sonic 3 game. What we aren't sure about, and I'm not sure if anyone will ever know, is why Michael Jackson's name was scrubbed from the game. Was it because, as Jackson's team says, it was because he didn't want his name associated with this music that wasn't high profile, it was kind of just bleepy bloopy? Or is it what Roger Hechter claims, that the child molestation allegations came out and Sega did not want Michael Jackson's name associated with a game for kids?
Well, this all begins with one obsessed fan. It's so hard to know what to think about such a strange story. And I'm wondering, for you, did writing the story, did it make you think differently about the conspiracy theorist community at large, or was this just a kind of a fluke to you?
I'd like to think that with this story, there's a little bit of a shimmer of hope that sometimes there's like treasure at the end of the treasure map, or there's still kind of hidden magic out there. But I don't know. I don't know if my thoughts have changed on conspiracy theories like all politicians are reptiles or Paul McCartney is dead. I think that's a whole other thing.
I guess that'll take some further investigation.
Yes, that'll be next year.
Todd Van Luling, senior staff writer at the Huffington Post, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can check out Todd's article and some videos comparing music from Sonic 3 to Michael Jackson's music. Links to do that at wordofmouthradio.org. When it comes to cars, commuters, and congestion, LA's freeways are legendary. But some people believe those traffic jams aren't just a source of consternation, but the result of a conspiracy. And this story comes to us from Roman Mars and the podcast 99% Invisible.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars, and this is Eric Malinsky.
Hi, I'm Eric.
Eric is an independent producer in New York City.
Brooklyn, of course, like most public radio producers here.
But before Brooklyn, Eric spent 10 years in Los Angeles.
Yeah, when I was in LA, I used to hear this story pretty often, and the story, it's almost like a fable. LA had this, you know, amazing transportation system called the Red Car, and it was this trolley that covered the entire city. And then after World War II, either Ford or GM bought the Red Car, had it dismantled, and then built this, you know, horrible freeway system that created the sprawl and gridlock of today.
What the hell's a freeway?
Eight lanes of shimmering cement running from here to Pasadena. Smooth, safe, fast. Traffic jams will be a thing of the past.
And, you know, the first time I heard the story, I thought, well, that sounds familiar. It must be true. I feel like I've definitely heard this story before.
That's because it's the plot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Or at least it's the evil scheme that Christopher Lloyd reveals at the end of the movie.
Come on. Nobody's gonna drive this lousy freeway when they can take the Red Car for a nickel.
Oh, they'll drive. They'll have to. You see, I bought the Red Car so I could dismantle it.
What the?
This isn't totally ridiculous. Remember the plot of Chinatown, where a Los Angeles mogul was stealing water from Northern California? That actually happened.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
As I learned more about the history of LA, I learned that the Red Car was actually not the victim of a massive conspiracy. The Red Car actually was the conspiracy. The Red Car helped create the sprawl and the gridlock.
To understand how this all came about, we have to go way back to the mid-19th century. A boy named Henry Huntington was born into a middle-class family in upstate New York, but he has a very wealthy uncle named Collis Huntington.
Collis has no kids, and he sort of latches on to his nephew. And, I mean, I assume he must see something in Henry, you know, that he thinks this kid can be molded into a businessman, and he's right. And so Collis takes little Henry under his wing. He teaches him everything about the family business, which is railroads.
Jump to 1900. Collis dies, and Henry thinks he's going to inherit the company, Southern Pacific.
But the board doesn't want another Huntington in charge, so Henry's out. And he gets a consolation prize, which is $15 million, which back then was about maybe like $400 million today. And he takes his cash, and he goes south to Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles really shouldn't exist. I mean, because, you know, the LA River was a mess, and it was so prone to flooding, it would actually change its location on the map.
The only decent harbor is Long Beach, but San Diego has a bigger center of commerce.
And downtown LA is like way far to the east.
A disconnected flatland. But where many people saw the desert, robber barons of the late 19th century saw something else. a blank slate.
So the modern city of Los Angeles, as we know it, was created as sort of like a counterweight to San Francisco, which was liberal even back then and had very strong unions. And LA was an open shop. Like a businessman like Henry Huntington had free rein. And he starts by purchasing the biggest transportation system in the city, which was the Los Angeles Railway, otherwise known as LARI. And he incorporates it into a new company called Pacific Electric. I talked to a bunch of historians about this, including Bill Friedrichs, who grew up in Los Angeles.
I have this vague recollection of a streetcar running up and down the main drag, which was Brand Boulevard, and I think I can remember the bell ringing of the streetcar.
Really? What did it sound like?
Ding, ding. I don't know.
Friedrichs actually wrote a book about Henry Huntington.
The key to Henry Huntington's operation was that this was before a lot of regulation in the area, so Henry pretty much decided where development would occur by building a streetcar line out to the area, just ahead of development, and most frequently he was building the streetcar lines out to where he owned the land.
So to put this in modern terms, the red car was kind of like the Kindle. Amazon loses money on the Kindle because they want you to use this e-reader as a portal to buy lots of, you know, bigger stuff on their website. And so the red car was a portal to get you to buy other bigger stuff from Henry Huntington.
Like your entire life.
He never really made money with the Pacific Electric, but it took people out to his subdivisions where he sold them land, frequently sold them water. He controlled some water companies. He also established an electric operation called the Pacific Light and Power Company. It was essentially set up to provide electricity to his trolley cars, but he ended up selling electricity to the city of Los Angeles.
Now, even back then, this was not business as usual.
There are lots of other streetcar developers, but they're much smaller, and they frequently went bankrupt. Other developers owned land, and they'd build a trolley out to some land, but not the immense amount of land that Huntington controlled. So he's sort of a complete package coming down.
So from 1904 to 1913, Huntington opens 500 new subdivisions every year. He controls more than 900 red cars on more than 1,100 miles of track.
That's about 25% more track mileage than New York City has today, 100 years later.
Now, I mean, historically, American cities grow organically in rings, you know, out of a downtown. And Huntington really forces Los Angeles to expand outward at twice the rate. And I think that really weakened downtown L.A. because he was creating these little downtowns along his trolley routes. So, you know, you think he's creating this empire. He's got the trains, he's got the electricity, he's got the land, he's got the water.
All he needed now were people.
Back then, you know, there are a lot of reasons not to like cities. I mean, they were dirty, they were crowded, they were dangerous. And Los Angeles was going to be this very different kind of city. That was the dream. And Huntington and Harry Chandler and all these other sort of L.A. power brokers went on this media blitz. And during the winter, they would blanket the Midwest with advertisements, you know, that Los Angeles is a paradise full of orange trees. The climate will cure your asthma. You can go surfing. And surfing was actually a relatively unknown sport until Henry Huntington hired a Hawaiian surfer named George Freeth to surf along Huntington Beach. And it worked. I mean, for a while, Long Beach was known as Iowa by the Sea because so many Iowans lived there.
But eventually, the dream went bust.
So now remember, Pacific Electric is designed to lose money. It's a portal to Huntington's real estate and other companies. And so the board of Pacific Electric is not happy about this. In the meantime, the red car is becoming a threat to Southern Pacific Railroad, which was, you know, the company that Huntington thought he was going to inherit from his uncle. So Southern Pacific wants to buy Pacific Electric. Huntington says no. His own board overrules him. He's forced to make a deal, and once again, his power and his ambitions are cut short.
But Henry Huntington gets the last laugh in a pretty weird way.
Because his uncle's fortune was split between him and his aunt Arabella. So Huntington marries his aunt and consolidates the family fortune. Now, it's actually not quite as icky as it sounds because they were not related by blood. She was his uncle's second wife.
But still.
Yeah. So Huntington actually lives happily ever after with his wealth and his aunt/wife. And he brings a lot of beauty to Los Angeles. He creates Huntington Gardens, the Huntington Library. He dies in 1927. And I don't know if he knew yet, but it was clear already to historians looking back that the red car was doomed.
Even though the overall track mileage rivaled New York, the red car wasn't comprehensive enough to go everywhere you needed to go by red car alone.
And they started to become poorly maintained. I mean, people started calling them slums on wheels.
The big turning point comes in 1926, a year before Huntington dies. Southern Pacific, which now owns Huntington's Pacific Electric, offers this massive plan to build subways and elevated trains all around downtown LA.
And this would be paid for by the taxpayer, so it's put up for a public referendum. And there's a lot of money spent, you know, a lot of advertising spent on both sides, just like referendums today. And the voters reject the plan.
People just didn't like Southern Pacific. They had meddled in California politics for so long that they called it the octopus.
Okay, so now remember the original sort of conspiracy theory that the car companies bought up the red car and tore them down and built up the freeways. So there was a subsidiary of General Motors called National City Lines, and they did buy trolley cars and they converted them into bus routes. And there were people at the time that thought it was a conspiracy. This wasn't this conspiracy that suddenly, you know, people discovered 50 years later. But the fact is Pacific Electric was doing the same thing to their own trolley cars.
As freeways became the norm and the red car became a thing of the past, you can see how a conspiracy theory could become cemented into the public imagination.
So when I first saw a map of the red car lines, I actually thought it was an early map of the freeways, which makes sense. These are the routes that people were using to get around. And in some cases, like the Cahuenga Pass, trains were actually dismantled to make way for the Hollywood Freeway. Santa Monica Boulevard is paved over a trolley route, and sometimes, you know, when I was heading to the 405, I'd actually drive over these phantom tracks.
LA's first freeway, the Arroyo Seco Parkway, which connects downtown to Pasadena, opened in 1940. A few years later, city planners proposed another plan for elevated railroads that was rejected by the city council. The last red car ran in 1961. And you have to think it was, in a way, a victim of its own success. Henry Huntington's goal was to connect his far-flung properties and create a decentralized city that you'd need a mass transit solution to get around. The problem was, he couldn't provide it. Over time, LA was so spread out that it overtaxed what the red car was capable of servicing.
I like to imagine, you know, if it's 1960 and I'm driving along the 10 freeway, I mean, I'm sure there was traffic, but it must have been pretty smooth. Because, I mean, the freeways that exist now were the same freeways back then, but built for a much smaller population. So they must have seemed like a really impressive solution at the time.
And today, Angelenos can appreciate the great solution of their highway system for hours and hours and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours.
Hours.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars, producer Eric Malinsky, and 99% Invisible. Thanks so much for spending some time listening today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And of course, you can listen anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review. Spread it around, word of mouth style. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too, here on NHPR.